Everybody got a dream. Let me show you all love. From an idea, working it into a startup. This the show that you need. What more could you ask for? Never know who become the CEO next door. Tune in, every episode insightful. The type of vibe you will want to subscribe to. Let's go.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the CEO Next Door. With us today is our co-host, Donovan Morrison. I'm Mike Mayer. And our esteemed guest today is Ken Rusk, president of Rusk Industries. And let's start it off by handing it over to Ken and learning a little bit about him and his background. Ken, take it away.
Well, thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate it. Yeah, my story is pretty simple. I've always been a blue-collar guy. I've been accused of being a blue-collar entrepreneur, if you will, whatever that means. And I run a company called Rusk Industries in Ohio. And it's a firm that encompasses three or four different types of construction concerns. And started back in 1986 with six people. And, we've grown to about almost 200. So it's been a crazy ride. But a good one.
I was going to ask, you mentioned blue collar entrepreneur and you kind of said, leave it up to us to define. How would you define that?
Well, first off, I think entrepreneur is something that's hard to define. I mean, I talk about the characteristics in the book, Blue Collar Cash, that define what an entrepreneur is. I think everyone has a little bit or a lot of each one of those characteristics. But for me, it's just someone who is who feels like and works hard at having control over their day, over their input, over their output, over the quality of their output, maybe over the scheduling, over the work that they do and the feedback that they get and the financial gain that they get. You know, I don't think you can get that in an office job sometimes when you're a small piece of a huge machine. So being a blue collar entrepreneur is really about kind of doing your thing and doing it the way you know how to do it, making it great, and then benefiting from that in the long run.
Ken, what is Rusk Industries? What do you guys do?
So we have three or four different companies, as I said. One of them, the main company, is a foundation company. It's a company that I've been working at since I was 15. It's actually, we actually dig ditches for a living here, and I've been doing that for a very long time. And that kind of morphed into construction, building houses, building office buildings. We had a piece of a chemical company that does construction type chemicals, and we build houses out in Missouri and develop a resort property. It's a lot of different things that keep me busy.
So sounds like both residential and commercial?
That's correct, yeah.
And what is kind of the breakdown? Where do you primarily focus your activities?
Well, for me, you know, my goal has always been as a CEO, if you will, to become irrelevant to the process. So I think it's important that if you want to grow your company, that you find people and incentivize them to work as a team to help grow that company with or without you. I think being, you know, the answer man, where you go home and your day is made because you said this, you did this, you told them to do that, and you showed them how to, I think that's kind of like old school for me. So I kind of touch each company just a little bit each day, and just kind of, I sit back and kind of watch what's happening and plug myself in wherever I feel is necessary.
Got it. So are you from Ohio originally, Ken?
Yeah, I'm from Cleveland originally and moved to Toledo back in 1986. So quite a few years now.
Okay. I think we'd love to learn, was your family entrepreneurial? Were you bit by the entrepreneurial bug at a young age? Where did this spirit come from?
Yeah. I mean, I had a couple of good examples when I was younger. My father was a pretty tough Marine, and he needed to be because he had five boys all under the age of 9 years of age at the time. So, you know, it felt like he ran our house like a platoon sometimes. And that was cool because we understood why that was necessary. But later in life, he became successful when I was like 15 or 16. And he showed me several examples of how to live and live well. And that was always intriguing to me. And then the gentleman that I actually went to work for when I was 15, before I opened my own company, he was the same way. I mean, he was a hard driving guy, but he loved to live life and have fun and do great things and cool things, unique and different things. So it was nice to see those two examples and kind of follow along with, well, you know, they did it, so I can do it. I mean, they got what they want for their life, and so can I.
So how did you get started? You had mentioned digging ditches from an early, early age. How did you get that first company going? What was it like? What did you do?
Yeah, so my high school shared a fence with an industrial park. And after school, we would cut through a hole in this fence and go hang out at the carryout when we were younger. And I always remember walking through this industrial park on my way to this carryout. And there was always a lot of things going on. There was a lot of energy. There was a lot of things that young guys liked. You know, there was dump trucks and backhoes and, you know, everyone milling around, a lot of energy, lots of sights and sounds and things really, really happening. So I just one day I knew someone that worked there, and I walked up and I said, you know, what are we doing here? And they said, well, we dig ditches. And I said, well, I can do that. You know, so in the summertime, I worked in the production department digging ditches and fixing old basements. And in the wintertime after school, I'd go work in the office. So I kind of got a handle on how the whole company worked just by observing it and working it. And when I turned 18, I was either going to go to college or not. And I tried it for a couple of months and I was like, you know, this isn't for me. I need to be out doing something with my hands. So they came to me one day and they said, hey, you know a lot of the different aspects of this company, so we need to start expanding around the country, and we're opening up these other offices, and we'd love to have you go spearhead that for us, or at least help us to open them. So I did that for probably 3 or 4 years. Got tired of living out of a suitcase, as you know, that's how it happens when you travel. And then I came here to Toledo, and we opened up our company, and that's been like 36 or 7 years now.
So when you opened your company, you were competing against the company you got your start with. Is that?
No, I ended up opening up a branch of their company. So they have a licensee, or almost like a franchise relationship. Franchise. So I ended up opening that and working it from there.
And you mentioned that your dad became successful when you were 15 or 16. So did he shift out of the Marines? And then was he in a similar field to what you are in now, or something completely different?
No, he did his stint in the Marines like most young guys do. He did it from like 18 to 20 or 21 years of age. And then he just went right to work. And believe it or not, he worked in grocery stores. And he became the youngest Kroger manager in the history of their store at 21 or 2 years of age. And he was just good at getting groups of people to work together. And he was good. He had a good eye for making the stores look great. And he was good at turning around stores that weren't doing so great. And then at some point, he was recruited away from that by a company that actually supplied grocery stores. They call them food brokers, if you will. And so he went there, but he ended up buying in as a junior partner and then bought the other partners out over time and became pretty successful in his own right at that point.
So from your dad's experiences, I think you alluded to learning some of your organizational skills from him. Any other major takeaways from growing up in a household where he was majorly successful in the grocery business? What did you learn from him growing up that you still implement or kind of take to heart to this day?
You know, it's hard to be a perfectionist, although, you know, you try, right? So for me, it was about all the detail. He was a very detail-oriented guy. Whenever I would wash his car, he would come out and inspect it afterwards, and there was lots of details that he would want me to either adjust or change or make better. So I think there was a lot of that where, you know, I wanted everything to be right. So I instilled in the people here that, you know, if we're going to do this, let's make it cool. Let's make it fun. Let's make it energetic. Let's make it colorful. Let's make it celebratory. And let's do it right. I mean, let's do things right. And so, you know, culture for me, positive go forward culture for me was a huge thing. And that's what we work on here almost every day.
What do you do in the current role to incentivize people? You mentioned that's important for you and something that was important to your father also with leading teams at Kroger.
again, you know, I've always believed that I can't get what I want from my company, nor can I get what I want for myself until everyone in my company gets what they want first. I mean, it's kind of an input-output thing. So for me, it was always about getting involved in their personal lives. You know, what are you doing for yourself? I mean, you know, when people come into our organization, I actually want them to be selfish. And I don't mean that at the detriment of others, but I mean selfish, you know, focusing on you. And the more people that can obtain the goals that they want for themselves, the more people that can live the life that they want for themselves and what they see in their mind with and through my company, the better off I'm going to be and the better off the company is going to be. So we are constantly pushing personal goals, personal development. And I don't mean just gray area stuff. I mean, down dirty, real specific goals, financial futures. Again, there's always music and culture and celebrations and accolades and milestones. There's always something going on. There's food. I mean, there's all kinds of things we do here just to try to create a really cool culture because, you know, we're in a business that is tough. It's dirt, it's concrete, it's jackhammers, it's cement. I mean, it's not easy to do. So we took something that was kind of uncool and made it cool.
So what did your parents or father say when you decided not to go to college and to pursue this route? Were they supportive or was there some pushback?
Well, he didn't go to college either. So he got it. But I would say this. I mean, he left it up to me. But when he found out that I was going to go to, you know, all these cities like Chicago, Cincinnati, Columbus, you know, Pittsburgh, and I was going to open these offices and kind of like, you know, almost live there for 6 months to a year. One of the things that I said was, you know, you're going to be able to learn how to open a company on somebody else's dime. That's pretty good. You know, you'll learn what to do and what not to do. And then when it becomes your turn, you'll have it. So he said, I'm not going to tell you what to do either way. He said, but from what you're telling me, you're actually going to college in what you're attempting to do by opening these companies. I mean, you couldn't get that kind of schooling in any university. So yeah, it was a no-brainer for me to go and just try to grow my own knowledge base, my own skills. And, you know, when you're 18 years old and you're telling a 6'2", 300-pound, you know, union plumber in Chicago how you want something done, that's pretty intimidating, but it gave me some of the experiences I still have today.
So throughout the years, it sounds like your business has expanded. You have different departments or different sub companies. How did that transpire? How did you kind of spin off or add new service offerings?
You know, whenever your company grows, the goal is to replicate yourself over and over and over. So if I was in the beginning doing 10 things, now I have 10 people doing those 10 things. And it's just kind of a natural growth pattern. As you grow, you need more supervision, you need more payroll, you need more accounting, you need all these different things, financing, whatever it might be, marketing, lead generation, all that kind of stuff. So as those positions became necessary, we just filled them with people that had been, you know, with our organization through the whole time. And then, you know, I said, look, okay, so if this company can get to a place where now I can go out and seek other opportunities, invest in other opportunities, then I can share more of my company's wealth with you all, because I'm now earning money not only here, but somewhere else as well. So in other words, the more freedom you give me to go out and explore these other opportunities, the more it's going to benefit you, because there'll be more revenue coming in, more revenue to share, more profit sharing type scenarios and that kind of thing. So it was pretty easy for them to kick me out of the nest and send me out hunting these other things, because they knew they would benefit from it in the end.
So is your company still tied to your original company in any capacity, or was there a buyout at some point? Because I know you said it was tangential yet connected when first starting out.
Yeah, no, they, you know, what we work on here is, and again, guys, you have to remember ownership is a double-edged sword, because there's risk, there's liability, there's, you know, worry, all the things that when you own something and you've got 40 or 50 trucks on the road, you know, there's a lot of risk and sweat and trepidation with something like that. So what I did is I told, I went to the staff and I said, if we can create departments that you feel like you own, and what I mean by that is you become what's known as an entrepreneurial employee. You're not quite on your own, but you're not risking your financial wherewithal either. So I position them to where they feel like they own their departments. They schedule their own days. They schedule their time. They schedule their financing. They schedule their budgets, their revenue. And so they kind of own their own departments and make their own decisions. And it's kind of cool because they almost feel like owners, even though they're not, but they get to benefit from ultimately being an owner is great because you get to be compensated well for that. And so they can get compensated well without the risks on the other side. So, you know, they're happy to you know, be in control of their own future and make great things happen.
How does your business break down as far as your departments and where the, you know, kind of the percentage of activity revenue, like what kind of drives the business and what are ancillary services?
When you're in a business like mine, it's what you call people intensive. Okay. It's not machinery intensive. So there's a lot of people that are involved in marketing. There's a lot of people that are involved in sales. We have a marketing department. We have a sales department. And we have a kind of a lead flow, almost like a traffic cop department where all the leads come in and they get put out to all the sales force. That turns into contracts that we get, which are then financed through our finance department. They then go to the production department and where the jobs are all installed, if you will. And then we hopefully create a referral and then go out and get a new customer. So it's kind of a full circle thing and everybody knows how they support each one of those scenarios. So if you can imagine most of those departments were around at the beginning. It's just, there were very few people and, or mostly me doing them. And now we've blossomed that into, like I said, almost 200 people. But there's you know, the best way to look at this, guys, is real simple. When you're running a company, you can either spend less or sell more. You know, God forbid you do both. And that's what we're trying to do almost every day.
So who is your main customer? Are you selling to developers or like construction groups? Who are a few of your main targets?
Mostly we sell to residential people. You know, we're working on residential homes when we're fixing or repairing them. I mean, you know, probably 50% of my business is going up to an old house, you know, jacking it up in the air, ripping the basement out, putting a new basement in and setting it back down. And it's quite an undertaking. So that's residential on the repair side. On the build side, obviously it's if you're talking about a resort, we're building houses in Branson, Missouri, right on a lake. And those are for people, it's either their vacation home or it's a rental home. So it could be a rental property investor that's doing it. But these are brand new builds and that's what we're doing out there.
I would love to learn more about the process of lifting a home up to redo the basement. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, you know, when you think about it, a house sits on the basement, but it also sits on, you know, I-beams and support posts, okay? So those I-beams and support posts are kind of like the inner footing of the house. The exterior footing is the basement walls. So if you have a house that's got a troubled basement, you go in and you basically jack it up from the center near the ends, but not on the ends because you have to get to the wall. And you just very, very slowly just lift this house, I don't know, maybe two feet max, you know, maybe 1 or 2 feet max. And then you just shore it up and you leave it there. You build a little bridge for the homeowner to walk across to get to their house every day. And then, I mean, it's a scary looking process, but it's, you know, it's something that happens every day. So tear the basement walls out, you put them back in as fast as you can, and then you set that thing back down. And it's a pretty cool thing because someone gets a brand new basement, brand new foundation, and then they can actually use it.
Can you do this process with any size home? It seems like a small home would be more achievable, but.
Oh yeah. I mean,
can you do this with a 4,000 square foot home?
Yeah. There's one that is being done out in Port Clinton, Ohio right now, which is right between Sandusky and here. And it's easily a 3,600 to 3,800 square foot old farmhouse. And yeah, you just lift it up and put new feet underneath it and set it back down.
So how long does that process take?
Yeah.
Oh, that's at least a 3-week process, sometimes more. Depends on how long it takes you.
That seems fast.
Get up in the air. Yeah, it is pretty quick, but you know, if you get a half a dozen guys down there throwing up concrete block, it doesn't take too long.
So the majority of the time, do you work with folks who just want to renovate or finish their basements? Or is it more like there's a structural issue that needs to be addressed? We need to get in there.
That's a great question. One leads to another. So almost every time that we get in there, there's a structural issue, but people fix those structural issues for different reasons. Some they're fixing it just because they don't like the structural issue. Some they're fixing because they want to finish it off. Some fix it because they want to sell the house. So, you know, they all start out with the same problem, but the reason they're doing it changes based on the homeowner.
Got it. So in addition to this, it appears you have some other endeavors. You wrote a book. Is that correct?
Yeah, I wrote a book called Blue Collar Cash. And I wasn't intending on writing a book. It just kind of happened. And, one thing led to another and just one domino fell after another. Really great stuff. I mean, I found an editor and then he found me an agent. And then we found a digital PR person and a media PR person. And we got a publisher. HarperCollins came in and we had actually six publishers that were actually out trying to outbid each other to get this book. And I didn't think it would go 10 feet, much less 10 miles, but we arrived at bestseller status last fall. And that was a really cool thing. So yeah, it's been quite a ride there.
So what do you hit on in the book? What are some of the major themes that you get across?
Well, there's several. You know, in the world we live in today, you have to always look at supply and demand. Supply and demand is a force that cannot be messed with, okay? Unless you manipulate the numbers somehow. But so where supply is low and demand is high, that's where the money always goes. I mean, that's just how it works. So, you know, we have all these kids that are being told that college is the only way you'll ever be successful. Well, if half the people in the country still to this day do something with their hands, how can that be true? The answer is it's not true. It's never been true, but colleges are so good at extracting money from people that they want it to be true. And they want you to believe that it's true. And they even purport the stigma of being a blue collar person. You know, if you don't go to college, you're going to be flipping burgers. That's ridiculous. It's never been that way. But, you know, they make a lot of money with that statement, so they're going to keep doing it. For me, I'm not an anti-college guy at all. If you're going to operate on my shoulder so that I can get back out on the golf course, I want you to know everything there's to know about a knife before you pick it up, okay? Same thing goes with an accountant or a lawyer or, a dentist or a teacher or an architect. You have to know those things. Those are job-specific degrees. But we're trying to shove every kid through this new thing now called a college prep high school, which no one can define. And we're trying to put all 100% of our future kids into college. And if that happens, you know, who's going to be the plumber, the electrician, the welder, the baker, the guy that owns his own restaurant or his own flower shop? Who's going to wire outlets? Who's going to build things, fix things, repair things? The answer is not as many people. And when that happens, all the money goes that way, which is happening now. We have finished carpenters making $150,000 a year. We have welders making $120,000 a year. We have electricians making, you know, in excess of $150,000 to $200,000 a year, as do plumbers. And that's going to only get worse. So for me, I thought, well, somebody better ring the alarm bell here because no one's paying attention. The pendulum has swung towards college only or you're going to be a bum. And that's just ridiculous. So I put out Blue Collar Cash to talk about, can we all focus maybe on what we want our lives to look like first going forward 5, 10, 20 years in advance? Because once we know that in a really clear way, it doesn't really matter how you get there. There's lots of paths to being successful. College is only one of them. And so I just needed to speak for that kid who, you know, was in high school thinking, well, man, I really want to be a carpenter. And everyone's telling me if I don't go to college, I'm going to be a bum. That's ridiculous. I also wanted to help people who maybe did that, didn't follow their passion, but went to school. And now they're 10 years into a sales job in the cubicle on the 15th floor of some building. And they're like, man, I don't like this. I hate this. Why am I doing this? And there's a lot of those people. I'd rather be out building furniture or doing what I originally loved to do. So the book's good for transitioning. And then there's actually a third reader, which I didn't expect, but I have an awful lot of people that are buying this book from a corporate standpoint, giving it to their employees, and they're having like a book club with it where they discuss how can we as a team work together, dream together, succeed together, and then drive the company forward. So it's been pretty interesting, the three different types of readers that we've had. But yeah, it's been great. I think it's a message that needs to be heard.
So do you think there will be a second book, or is this a one and done experience?
No, I think there is probably a second book. You know, that last reader that I just told you about, the corporate reader, you know, I think there's a whole lot of teaching how to build proper culture in your office building or in your business. You know, so many people are so late to the game, like, oh, wow, I put an ad in the paper and nobody calls me. I mean, I used to have a foyer full of people for every ad I put in. Well, you're competing now for these people. And the people that are coming in are fewer and fewer. So if your culture isn't really cool, there's no reason they're going to want to work there. So, you know, for us being in the ditch digging business, we've had to have cool culture forever. This is not new to us. I mean, this is something we've had to do just to attract workers. And so that's why I think there could be a book that teaches people in the corporate world how to create a really awesome place to work and attract great people that way.
How are you guys doing as far as attracting, you know, new employees? I mean, most of the country is suffering, trying to fill, you know, more of the blue collar type roles. I'm sure you're probably seeing some of the same, you know, issues.
Well, you know, that's the funny thing, because, you know, I hear a lot of people that say, man, nobody wants to work. Well, that's not true. You just have to give them a reason why they want to work. And that reason isn't your reason. That reason is their reason. Again, it goes back to that selfish comment I made earlier. You know, it's okay to be selfish as long as it's good for you and not at the detriment of others when it comes to your work. And so, yeah, we have a staff of almost 200 and we're full. And you know, there's not a waiting list, but we're full and we bring in talent all the time. But we don't suffer like a lot of these other companies do, because we spend a lot of time evaluating the employee, being concerned about his or her future, mapping out what they want to do with their lives, getting their retirement out of the way as soon as they walk in the door. You know, lots of things that we do to make an employee feel like, wow, this is a place that I can get what I want for myself with and through this company. So I'm going to hang around. Mm-hmm.
What's your take on the latest work from home movement? That must be tough with most of your team.
Well, yeah, you know, I think the jury is still out on that. I think we're going to look back on this 5 or 10 years from now and probably do a study on, you know, were we really more productive because we worked in our pajamas and sat in front of a computer screen all day? I don't know. I think the jury, now, obviously you can't plant a pine tree if you're working, working in your home. So a lot of the blue collar jobs don't have that ability. Okay, you can't have a blue collar job and work from home. I mean, it just doesn't work. So I think we're going to look back, and certain companies that said they were super productive are going to find out they weren't. Maybe some companies, because their policies were, you know, relaxed a little bit, their employees were better, and those companies benefited. So I don't know. I think it's going to be a study. I think we're going to learn something in a few years about how this whole thing went through.
So Ken, it sounds like you're juggling a number of things between book promotion, the company. I think I saw you do some like coaching and mentoring as well. How do you stay sane? How do you keep a level head when approaching all of these different aspects of your life?
Well, that's a really easy answer. So I'm assuming both of you have been on vacation sometime in the last 5 years, and I'm going to assume that you planned that vacation. And when you planned it, you visualized it, you probably scheduled a bunch of things like, I need a plane ticket, I need a hotel, I need a destination, I can't wait to go to the beach, I'm going to sit in my beach chair, I'm going to have my drink, I'm going to listen to my music, I'm going to smell the air, I'm going to feel the breeze, the suntan lotion, the warmth of the sun. You know, you kind of, every one of us is really good at anticipating and or planning a vacation. So for me, I thought, well, why aren't we living a life of anticipation in all the things that we do? Why aren't we anticipating our hobbies, our next house, our next car, our next pet, our next charity event, our family, and those types of things? Why aren't we anticipating just as well as we do with a vacation all the other things in our lifetime? And for me, there's always 5 or 6 things that are either 1 month, 6 month, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years out. And I just focus on, am I moving forward? And, you know, the sanity just comes. I mean, you got to have balance in your life, right? We don't live to work. Okay. We work so that we can live. And you got to keep that balance in your mind going forward when you do that.
Well, on that note, what does your daily routine look like? How do you keep that sanity and keep that balanced?
Well, first off, my daily routine is I wake up and I go to the same spot every morning at 7 o'clock, and I make my protein shake in my, I have a pub on my first floor of my house, and it's a ritual, and I have a frame there, and it's a frame that's one of those electronic frames that rotates pictures. So there's probably 2,000 pictures on this thing, and I constantly add to it. So I'll make my protein shake, and I'll look at that frame, and I'll just be grateful. I wake up every day, and I talk about how grateful I am that I've been able to do these things, see these things, experience these things, and have these people in my life. And so that's something that I do almost, you know, it's just unconsciously. I do that every morning. And then I always get in a workout. I believe that your company's no good if you're no good. So it's a me first thing. I like to take care of myself. I'm a vitamin guy. I'm a, like I said, a protein shake guy. I'm a health hobbyist. So that's all comes first. And then I go to the office and I just plug myself in where I want to. I get to talk to nice guys like you. Yeah, I just kind of watch over, just check out, you know, kind of take a temperature of everything and plug myself in where I want to, and then, you know, make some things happen.
So what's next for the business? What's in the pipeline for you?
I'm so good at predicting how big my company is going to grow that I'm going to be starting my fifth building. Okay. That's a play on words, meaning I had no idea how big it would grow. So yeah, I built a building. It wasn't big enough. I built another one. It wasn't big enough. I built another one. It wasn't big enough. I built another one, and we're outgrowing it. So now we're getting ready to build our fifth one. And now that's over 36 years, but that's a project that we're going to start here, hopefully in the next 6 months. We're in the planning stages now. And then, you know, that when you grow like that, that affords you to bring more people into the fold from a management, from a profit standpoint, from a big picture vision kind of thing, and just see where it goes from there. We've taken on some new territories. So we've added a whole bunch of new counties that we can start marketing to and try to grow there as well. So yeah, it's going to be a pretty cool 5 years, and we'll see where it heads from there.
Your story is very interesting. One of the reasons people tune into our podcast is, you know, for an education. So I think the best way to learn is by doing things and potentially making mistakes. Take us back through your journey as an entrepreneur and tell us some of the mistakes you made and what you learned from those mistakes.
Well, first off, I wish I had invested really early, like I'm talking 21 years of age, because what I learned over time is the power of young money is so intense. You know, there's a really quick example. If you're 21 years old and you put $60 a week away into a 401k, you can stop saving 10 years later and you have about 33 grand in there. But by the time you retire, you have $1,000,001 in your retirement account. Most people don't know that. Why we don't teach that, I have no idea, but we don't. Mm-hmm. So early investing is something that I wish. Now, you know, I started in my early 30s, so it wasn't a tragedy, but you have to save a lot more money just to get the same amount of money as a 21-year-old did. So it's the power of young money is amazing. I encourage anyone to go look at some of those calculations and just you'll be blown away about the difference of what you'll have in the end. But I think the other mistake was I learned this, but not early enough. And I learned it, you know, by mistake almost. In the book, I talk about having a life clock, and I got this from a friend of or from my staff 1 year. And it's a clock that you enter your age and you hit go, and it starts to wind your life down in minutes, seconds, hours, and days. And so you learn to become very, very productive when you think about how valuable the asset of time is. So I would say time is a huge thing that people need to realize how important it is, and be very careful how much of it you waste and how you use your time. So in that respect, you know, not wanting to be the guy that did it all, you know, answered all the questions, saved all the days, and you know, you told everybody what to do and how to do it, and that made you feel valuable and that made you feel good about what you're doing. I wish I had learned earlier on that become irrelevant to your company, allow others to grow, and then watch it and you know, get out of the way, because they'll take it a lot further than you could on your own.
Donovan, you have any other questions?
I think just kind of as we wrap up, we always like to leave our listeners with kind of a final parting thought. So any last nuggets of wisdom that you can share today?
Yeah, you know, I wrote this book not to make money, because my life was really good before I did it. And I'm very grateful. I'm very blessed. So I wanted this book not to just be something that you read and put on the shelf like a trophy. Like, look at all the books I've read. Well, can you tell me about what's in any of them? Well, I don't know. I forgot. Okay. So I built this course. It's a course that I invested a lot of money and time into over the past year. And it's a course that takes that book and puts it into life. It forces you to take what you've learned and change your life, or at least change the way you think about your life. Now, I've seen courses that are 500, 2000, whatever, for people. No, this course is $99. You get a free $25 book, Blue Collar Cash, with it. And if you purchase that, I will send one to someone of your choice absolutely free, a book and a course. If you don't have anybody, then we'll donate it locally to someone in need here in our local area. The point is, I think giving back is extremely important. You never do it because you expect something, but it just seems to kind of happen that way. The more you give, the more you receive. And I don't know if it's karma, or I can't put my finger on why it happens, but when someone's willing to give, they tend to be blessed with more so that they can give more. And so just know that if you get involved in Blue Collar Cash, the course and the book, not only are you helping yourself, I guarantee you're going to help yourself change your life, but you're going to help somebody else out in the process.
Well, I hope people take you up on that offer. That's very generous. Well, Ken, it's been a real pleasure having you on the show today. Thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, and good luck with the show. I hope it works great for you guys.
Thanks, Ken.
Everybody got a dream, let me show you all love. From an idea, working it into a startup. That's this right. The show that you need, what more could you ask for? Never know who become the CEO next door. Tune in, every episode insightful. The type of vibe you will want to subscribe to. Let's go. Hey.